that kind of conversation to your soul. That's conversation to your soul and the night.
Prestige heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison, and we are excited to bring you the news. Derek, unfortunately, but as usual, very grim start this week. Let's talk about Gaza, and let's talk about the fact that famine appears to have fully set in.
Yes, there's a monitoring system called the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, and there's a group that is relied upon to make designations about levels of food insecurity. And on Monday, they announced that some 70% of the population in northern Gaza is at their most severe level of food insecurity.
Doctors at the neonatal intensive care unit at Emirati Hospital say an increasing number of babies are dying because of acute malnutrition.
Most are born with breathing problems, so we place them in incubators until they gain the proper weight, and then they're discharged. Unfortunately, after 5 days or a week, the baby returns in a bad condition. Many of them have died.
To qualify as a famine, an area needs to have 20% of its population in that state. So obviously they're well beyond that. The IPC overall puts about half of Gaza's population at that most severe level of food insecurity. So the entire territory is now, aside from being qualitatively in a state of famine, is now quantitatively, according to the recognized international system that's used for making these determinations, in a state of famine. We know that people are dying. Children are dying of malnutrition at this point. There are some efforts, which we've talked about, underway to try to get around the blocks that the Israeli government primarily has set up on aid shipments coming in by land. None of those have panned out so far. There is this U.S. military effort, I guess, boondoggle, if you want to be more cynical about it, to build a port, a pier system, basically offshore, and float it to Gaza. That's, again, even if it started today, I guess, the U.S. has dispatched ships, but as far as I know, the work hasn't started. That's a 2-month process under the best circumstances to actually get anything done. So it's not responsive to the situation as it is right now. And there's good reason to wonder whether the U.S. government cares about responding to the situation as it is now, or just wants to appear to be responding. I think probably more the latter than the former. Even Antony Blinken, we'll get to him, he's in the region this week, commented that essentially the entire population of Gaza is in some state of food insecurity, whether in the worst possible classification or not. That's somewhat remarkable for the U.S. to even U.S. officials to even be like, "Wow, gosh, look how bad this has gotten," as though it were a dry season or a hurricane hit or something, as opposed to a man-made block on food that the United States government is supporting wholeheartedly and has done all the way through.
Thanks, Derek. So what has been going on in Rafah? And there appears to be tension between the United States and Israel about what should be done.
Yes. I mean, there's been tension for a while, at least, again, on the surface. You get all these stories about how, gosh, Joe Biden is just so mad at Benjamin Netanyahu, and they're really frustrated in there in the White House, and oh boy, it's coming. There's going to be a reckoning. That fake hot mic moment at the State of the Union where he's told, I forget who he was talking to, and said he was going to have a come to Jesus talk with Netanyahu, just all kind of stage managed. Nevertheless, Biden did talk to Netanyahu apparently by phone on Monday. They discussed, among other things, the forthcoming Israeli military operation in Rafah, the city in southern Gaza, where hundreds of thousands of people displaced from other parts of the territory are now congregated. The United States has been insisting that the Israeli government draw up what it calls an actionable plan to evacuate those civilians before going in. The Israeli government has not, to my knowledge, done that. They've talked instead about allowing civilians to leave, maybe opening up a corridor for them to go north, but there's no plan in place to make sure that happens or to enable it to happen, as far as I know. And nobody in the Biden administration says they've seen any such plan. So the U.S., under those conditions, without a plan to deal with the civilians, has been very publicly saying that they don't support, the Biden administration doesn't support an operation into Rafah. So this call was to discuss options, I guess. Biden was urging Netanyahu, we're told, to try a different tactic, maybe a more targeted counterterrorism tactic, as opposed to as opposed to a full blown incursion that will probably kill a lot of people. The upshot, the result of that meeting was that Netanyahu apparently agreed to send a delegation, two people from his circle, to Washington to hear a pitch, basically, from the U.S., from the Biden administration, about ways that they could go about taking down Hamas or targeting Hamas in Rafah without, again, the full-blown ground invasion. Netanyahu then promptly on Tuesday told members of the Knesset that he's going into Rafah anyway, and Joe Biden can go F himself, basically. I mean, not in those words, but you know, the sense is that he's just sort of humoring Biden by sending this delegation, and there's no intention of actually changing the plan at this point. Netanyahu has been pretty adamant about insisting that the Rafah operation will happen, and will happen the way he wants it to happen. And I think defying or being seen to defy the U.S. is politically useful for him in his efforts to appease some of the more extreme factions in his coalition. It's also just what he's inclined to do. I mean, at this point, he is inclined to, I think, kill as many people as possible. So where things stand is, again, this kind of kabuki theater where the U.S. is opposed and we're doing something. And, you know, anybody who's reconsidering their vote for Joe Biden in November, look at us. We're doing something. And in reality, it's all for show. Much like, I should add, the effort to sanction settlers, which did take another step. I think over the past week, the administration announced a few new sanctions against violent West Bank settlers. It also sanctioned for the first time a couple of settlement outposts. These are not full settlements. They are farms, essentially, that settlers set up illegally. Even under Israeli law, they go out beyond the boundaries of what are considered legal West Bank settlements by the Israeli government and set up these outposts that the Israeli government says, oh no, don't do that, that's illegal, and then later comes along and legalizes them, and that's how they keep expanding the footprint of the settlements. And these, the two that the Biden administration sanctioned, have apparently been used as basically forward operating bases in attacks against Palestinian civilians in the West Bank. Nevertheless, we're still at the level of like piecemeal, you know, this guy is a bad guy, this place is a bad place. There is some reason to hope, I guess, if you're looking for something to latch onto, that these piecemeal sanctions could become something more serious. And they do have, as sanctions, U.S. sanctions have all over the world, a chilling effect on banks and other institutions. Once you start down that road, you know, institutions get very nervous about doing business with anybody or anything that could be connected to the things that are being sanctioned, because the penalties can be severe. So there's some reason to, I guess, hope that the sanctions package will continue to expand and will really become a threat to the settlement movement. But at this point, you know, again, it's part of the theater.
Thanks, Derek. Why don't we talk about these ceasefire talks and Antony Blinken's trip, as you already mentioned, to the region?
Yes. So there are ceasefire talks underway again. They had broken down, of course, before Ramadan. They're underway again as of this week in Qatar. The Israelis dispatched a team to participate in those talks. They had been boycotting the last round, which was in Egypt. There was some discussion, or there's been some discussion this week, that Hamas has sort of softened its negotiating positions, that they're no longer insisting, for example, on a path to a full into indefinite ceasefire at the end of the temporary ceasefire and prisoner exchange process. And instead, they're willing to accept what is basically a 6-week ceasefire, after which the Israelis will, no question about it, resume their military operations. There, despite that, I haven't seen any indication of movement toward a deal. Again, you get these kind of vague comments from the Qatari government or from, you know, U.S. officials about a new sense of optimism in the talks, but no indication of hard progress. Now, Blinken, as you mentioned, is headed back to the Middle East to, I guess, further those talks. Now, his record when it comes to ceasefire talks in this conflict is not good, needless to say, but he is nevertheless trying to go and, I guess, put the cherry on top of the proverbial sundae. He went on Wednesday. His first stop was in Saudi Arabia. The Biden administration still seems to believe that the prospect of normalizing relations with the Saudis could convince Netanyahu to step back from the wholesale slaughter of people in Gaza. There's no indication of that. And in fact, Netanyahu has said he doesn't care enough about normalization with the Saudis to actually do that. But the Biden administration is still clinging to this belief that it can make this happen. So the first stop in Saudi Arabia. His second stop today on Thursday, as we're recording this, was in Egypt. Egypt being one of the moderators and mediators of the ceasefire talks. And then he's supposed to head to Israel on Friday, where he will, you know, harangue Netanyahu, and they won't listen. Netanyahu won't listen to him. And then he'll go home, probably having accomplished nothing. But, you know, I guess hope springs eternal.
He does rock, though. He's a pretty sick guitar player.
Yeah, so. He plays the guitar. You got to give it... Got to give him that. What a cool guy.
Jake, insert some Blinken guitar wailing here, please.
Plays guitar and lobbies on behalf of like Coca-Cola and stuff. He's all around.
All right. We laugh to keep from crying. Let's move on to the Pakistani airstrikes in Afghanistan.
Yeah, this seems serious. It wasn't a major incident, but it could be the start of something major. We've talked about this. In the past, the Pakistani government's frustration with the Afghan Taliban-led government in Kabul, which, you know, it supported. I mean, it supported the Taliban for most of the U.S. war in Afghanistan. The Pakistani government was giving the Taliban at least some tacit support, if not overt material support. But the hope, I think, on the part of the Pakistanis was that once the Taliban came back into power in Kabul, that they would be able to rein in the militant groups that have operated for years from Afghanistan, targeting Pakistan, launching attacks, and then going back across the border, et cetera, particularly the Pakistani Taliban, which is not the same as the Afghan Taliban. They have a certain affinity, especially ideologically, but, you know, different organization. That hasn't happened. I mean, the Pakistani Taliban is still attacking, still carrying out attacks, still, you know, hiding across the border in Afghanistan. And the frustration has been mounting. There was that a big deportation move last year on the part of the Pakistani government, which was born out of that frustration and just kicking, you know, undocumented Afghans out of the country. Now, on Monday, the Pakistani military, probably in retaliation for an attack on a military base in northern Pakistan in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province over the weekend, launched airstrikes in Afghanistan and border regions, claiming that they were targeting Pakistani Taliban positions. The Afghan government says that the strikes killed at least 8 people, all of them women and children. There's no way to verify that, of course, but you know, that's what they're claiming. They also say that they returned fire, that they shelled the Pakistani side of the border. I haven't seen any confirmation of that or any indication that if they did that, it caused any damage or casualties. But nevertheless, this clearly indicates that the frustration is growing on the part of the Pakistani government and you know, could lead to some bad places if it continues.
Thanks, Derek. Let's talk about the Indonesian elections, everyone. We've got an episode about this coming out, I believe, next Tuesday. So keep your ears peeled for that. I don't think that's a phrase. I think it's eyes peeled, ears open, whatever. But Derek, what's going on in Indonesia?
Yes, the Indonesian Election Commission on Wednesday confirmed that Defense Minister Prabowo Subianto won last month's presidential election. Official results give him somewhere between 58 and 59% of the vote. He's, you know, barring some unexpected complication, and there are challenges to the vote. We can talk about that in a moment being made, but it's unlikely they'll succeed. So he will assume office in October.
We must unite to eliminate poverty and eliminate hunger and eliminate suffering from our people, brothers and sisters.
Prabowo will become Indonesia's next president after he secured a majority in 36 of the country's 38 provinces.
We'll get into this actually in the interview on Tuesday, but Prabowo has a very checkered past. He was a loyalist of the infamous Indonesian dictator Suharto, was alleged to have carried out a litany of human rights abuses during that period when Indonesia was Suharto was committing human rights abuses virtually by the hour. Prabowo was implicated in a number of those. That seems to have not done his reputation terribly well among voters who are old enough to remember that period, but younger voters, not so much. They gravitated to Prabowo mostly because he ran with the son of President Joko Widodo, Gibran Rakabuming Raka, as his vice presidential candidate. And that really seems to have attracted a younger crowd. The challenges, both of the losing candidates, Anies Baswedan and Ganjar Pranowo, are challenging in court. They may launch a parliamentary challenge as well. They are particularly challenging the fact that Gibran was allowed to be on the ticket. He's too young by law to serve as vice president. But the court, which included people who were appointed by Joko Widodo, including, I guess, one of Gibran's uncles, ruled that it was okay because he'd been a governor. He was allowed to be on the ballot, even though he's legally too young for the job. So there's a lot of questions about the legality of that or the ethics of that decision that are the basis, I think, of this challenge to the outcome. But as I say, there's no reason to expect that they'll have any success in that regard.
Now on to bad news for me, given that I live in Seattle, which is that North Korea has tested a hypersonic missile engine.
Yes, I think you might be okay in Seattle, actually, but North Korean state media did report this week a successful test of what is probably, they didn't get into detail, but is probably the second stage engine for a hypersonic missile that the North Korean military is supposedly developing. It's intermediate range, so I don't think it's capable of hitting the lower 48 states, but it could hit Alaska, conceivably. It could hit Guam, military outposts, U.S. military outposts throughout the Pacific. Obviously, hypersonic gives you the impression that it's very fast. There's, you know, some question about how effective these things actually are. But regardless, it is definitely, the North Koreans at least intend it to seem like they are improving their deterrent capabilities or their abilities to cause pain to the United States in the event of a conflict. The other thing that's of note is that this engine is apparently solid fueled. I think we've talked about this before, the difference between a solid fueled engine and a liquid fueled rocket or missile engine is that solid fuel is stable, so you can store the missile armed and fueled and ready to fire without having to worry that it might accidentally go off. So that means you can pull these things out and fire them in fairly short order. Should the mood strike you, I guess. There may be, assuming that this engine test really was successful, there may be a full test of the weapon at some point in the not-too-distant future.
Some more great news. Derek, tell us what's going on at the Great Barrier Reef.
Yeah, I thought I'd put our bad environmental news in the middle of the news instead of at the end this week. Researchers have discovered indications of coral bleaching in some of the northern parts of the Great Barrier Reef. This comes as scientists have been warning for a while now that skyrocketing ocean temperatures, and they really are like record ocean temperatures every time, you know, somebody does one of these tests, it sets a new record, is going to cause another mass bleaching event basically around the world, probably worse than any of the previous mass bleaching events. So needless to say, this is not the kind of news that you would like to hear. Coral bleaching is devastating to the ecosystem. It's devastating to the ecosystems of these reefs. It's basically the coral in very high water very hot water when they're distressed. They eject the little creatures that live on them that give them color, and that leaves the coral itself vulnerable. And you know, usually it dies off at that point. And this affects, you know, has huge effects on the environment. It is reversible if ocean temperatures come down. There is a La Nina, apparently, that we're now forecasting to set in later this year that could bring ocean temperatures down, but whether that would be in time or enough to reverse this coral bleaching is, I think, unclear.
Thanks, Derek, always bringing the good news. Speaking of good news, let's talk about Sudan, and could you give us a humanitarian update?
Yes, the UN, there were UN agencies have been for about a week or so doing kind of updates to the Security Council about how serious the situation in Sudan is. And I keep bringing it up on the show because it's so bad. You know, it gets washed out by Gaza and Ukraine, but I don't think people should lose sight of just how dire the situation is. The UN now says that over 8 million people have been displaced since last April, when the Sudanese military and the Rapid Support Forces group went to war with each other. More than 18 million people in Sudan are facing acute food insecurity. That's up 10 million from this point last year. Over 700,000 Sudanese children, according to the UN, are suffering from severe malnutrition. And Martin Griffiths, who's the Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, told the Security Council that upwards of 5 million people could slip into what he called catastrophic food insecurity over the next several months across the country. So not good. And again, I just feel like we need to keep mentioning that, because otherwise it gets forgotten about.
American Prestige is brought to you in partnership with The Nation magazine. Please consider becoming a subscriber at americanprestigepod.com/subscribe. As a subscriber, you'll get access to dozens of exclusive bonus episodes, including breaking news specials, deep dives into regional histories, analysis of movies and video games, and much more. And if you subscribe at the founders level, you'll be able to claim a year digital subscription to The Nation. Thank you for listening, and now back to the show.
Let's talk about the junta in Niger, which has kicked U.S. forces out.
Yes, the junta, Niger's ruling junta, had for months maintained that it had no intention of kicking the United States out. The U.S. has bases in Niger, a drone base that's the main hub of its counterterrorism, quote unquote, counterterrorism operations in West Africa. So it's a very important country for the U.S. military. And as I say, the junta had indicated for months that it had no intention of going down the same road as it did with the French military, for example, kicking them out, or as, you know, its junta compatriots in Mali and Burkina Faso had done also with the French. But on Saturday, it announced that it is kicking the United States out. It's ending its military cooperation agreement, essentially, with the Pentagon, with immediate effect, according to the junta. This is the result, apparently, of a delegation that went to Niger last week, a U.S. delegation that it sounds like, from the descriptions that I've read, basically decided to lecture the junta about its relationship with Russia and its relationship with Iran. It raised this the issue. There's apparently some concern or some accusation floating around that the junta is selling or providing uranium to the Iranians. Of course, this feeds into fears about Iran's alleged nuclear weapons program. And the junta, unsurprisingly, didn't take very well to being lectured in this way and has told the United States to get out. In the days since then, this announcement came on Saturday. In the days since then, the U.S. military has responded to this by essentially adopting a pose of like a befuddled grandpa or something. I mean, it's hard to describe, but the junta issued this statement on Saturday that was very clear. We want the U.S. out. We're ending this agreement immediately. And ever since then, the response from the Pentagon has been, well, could you clarify that for us? Could you tell us what you really mean? You know, we're asking them to explain this, and we don't really know what's going on. And there's been mixed messages. This is the latest thing that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, C.Q. Brown, told reporters on Tuesday. We've gotten mixed signals from the junta. It doesn't seem very mixed, from at least publicly. Maybe privately they are, who knows. But anyway, I think this is all to stall for time, basically, because the Pentagon does not want to give up Niger. And if it does give up Niger, it's got to have someplace else to go, because, of course, the U.S. military never leaves a region. That could never happen. Are you kidding me? So it would have to find some other basing option. And the U.S. has talked to coastal West African countries, a number of them, about potentially putting bases in that area that could take over for the work that's being done in Niger. I guess it would take some time. So I think what they're doing basically is just pretending to not understand the message that they've gotten from the Nigerians and hopes that they can stall for time, either to make other arrangements or maybe to talk the junta down, to say, you know, I don't know if an apology would be in order, but to somehow smooth over whatever hurt feelings there are about that delegation and maybe maintain their presence in Niger. Who knows? But they're going about this as a sort of stall tactic, I think.
Derek, unfortunately, I remain still sanctioned. But nevertheless,
yeah, here's the bad news for you.
The Russian election has ended. Oh, tell us about the surprise victory.
Shockingly, Vladimir Putin won. I was hoping after he sanctioned you, I figured the backlash from the Russian public would be
Bessner drop.
Yeah, that they would come out in droves to get rid of him. He's running amok. But sadly, he did eke out a win. He just barely crossed the line. With a bit over 88% of the vote, was, you know, obviously a close race between Putin and whoever the hell was running against him. I have no idea, because it doesn't matter. And turnout, in case you're wondering, and this is where, you know, people in the West like to criticize, but turnout, and of course, the Russian government is meticulous at counting turnout as it is about counting the number of people who voted for Putin, was 74%, we're told. So big triumph for him all the way around. Congratulations.
Congratulations. Speaking of the region, let's talk about Ukraine striking targets in Russia.
Yes, we've mentioned this, I think, in past weeks, but there's been this trend upward in the frequency, at least, of Ukrainian drone strikes against targets inside Russia, primarily on the border, places on the border, and oil facilities deeper inside Russia. This is an asymmetric response to the invasion. The Ukrainians can't stand toe-to-toe with the Russian military in terms of manpower, and we can talk about that as well, but in terms of, you know, ammunition, any of the things that you need to sort of maintain parity on a front line, they're struggling right now to maintain that. But they can undertake, particularly because they've developed a stronger drone capacity since the start of the invasion, they can undertake these attacks in Russia to try to inflict pain on the Russians that would, in theory, cause the Russians to rethink their war aims. There's no indication that that's happened. And the oil facilities, you know, could be, I guess, in theory, if you struck enough of them severely enough, you could cause real logistical problems for the Russian military. Again, it's no indication that the Ukrainians are actually capable of pulling something like that off. Nevertheless, the governor of Russia's Belgorod Oblast, Vyacheslav Gladkov, did announce this week a number of emergency measures because of the frequency of attacks in that province in particular, that border province. Announced a number of emergency measures to in response to them. He's evacuating thousands of children from the border area. They're closing schools. They're shifting colleges and universities to basically distance learning so people won't be congregated on campus. So a number of things to show, I think, that there has been a toll taken here. It's not enough to, you know, really get the Russian government's attention, but there has been an impact here to life in these border regions, at least.
Thanks, Derek. And let's talk about this new debate about conscription.
Yes, the Ukrainian parliament is considering a bill that could mobilize upwards of 500,000 more soldiers, basically by lowering the minimum draft age and closing loopholes that allow people to avoid draftees to avoid military service. This is, it's the mobilization that the former commander of the Ukrainian military, Valery Zaluzhny, wanted, and that he told Volodymyr Zelensky, Ukrainian president, that he needed, and then Zelensky promptly fired him and replaced him with somebody else. It sounds like they're just going back to that idea, though. And there's really, no way around it. They are struggling to maintain manpower on the front line. The Russians continue to make incremental progress. They captured a couple of other villages in Ukraine's Donetsk Oblast this week. So they continue to make some small gains along the front line. And part of the reason is that the Ukrainian soldiers there are, they've been overtaxed. There's not enough of them. Their, tours at the front are too long. They don't have the wherewithal to kind of rotate people off the front line and give them a break. So more manpower would definitely be a boost to the war effort. The problem is they can't possibly raise enough soldiers. They can't expand conscription enough to overcome the sheer manpower advantage that the Russians have. And so what you're asking people to do, if you continue to just increase the size of the Ukrainian military, you're asking them to go to the front line. It's unclear how the Ukrainians would even logistically be able to train that large a number of conscripts to be anything more than just a body to be on the front line and get shot at. And there's a real issue here, I think, and I'm not trying to make any moral claims about the war or what should happen or anything like that, but there is a real issue at this point of essentially destroying an entire generation of Ukrainian men in this conflict for it's not even clear what the agenda is now. The idea of pushing Russia out of Ukraine seems just like a fantasy at this point.
Seems very, so, yeah. Without a massive intervention by either Western European powers or the United States, it seems very difficult to me.
So, the question of what you're getting all these people killed for, or risking their lives for, is I think an open one.
Speaking of, let's talk about the European Union, which is presently debating the use of Russian assets to support Ukraine.
Yes, there's an EU leader summit that opened on Thursday. It's a 2-day summit, so Thursday, Friday. One of the items on the agenda, the one of I guess most interest to us probably, is a plan proposed by the European Commission, the executive arm of the EU, to essentially take all the Russian assets, and there's hundreds of billions, like 250, maybe 300 billion euros in assets that the EU has frozen in various European institutions since the start of the invasion, and put those toward supporting the Ukrainian war effort. The proposal that the Commission drew up would not touch the principal of those assets. There are a lot of concerns that if you dig into the principle, you're going to set a precedent. You're going to have unsavory actors all over the world taking their money out of European banks, and nobody wants that. Nobody in Europe wants that. So the idea would be instead to take the profits, the financial profits generated by those assets, and give that to Ukraine while leaving the principle untouched. That could be somewhere between 2.5 million and 3 or 2.5 billion and 3 billion euros per year, which is not a ton if you think about, you know, some of these arms tranches that the U.S. has been sending to Ukraine have been, you know, in the multiple billions of dollars for just a couple of months of work, or there's the one that's still stuck in the house that is, you know, $60 billion dollars that the U.S. wants to send Ukraine. So $3 billion per year is not a huge amount, but it could buy ammunition. It could support one of the projects that the EU has in mind and that the Ukrainian government has in mind to expand Ukraine's domestic arms manufacturing industry, so it could produce ammunition itself that wouldn't have to go through the process of being exported and sent there. So there's a lot you could do with that amount of money. There's no consensus, as far as I know, within the EU about actually doing this. There are a number of leaders that are still nervous about the idea of going down this road. And a couple, at least, Viktor Orban in Hungary comes to mind, who have good relations with Russia and don't really agree with continuing to support Ukraine in the war. All of that makes for an internal opposition to this plan. So there's no expectation that they will decide to move forward at this summit, but they are going to talk about it.
All right. Let's talk about the Colombian government and its peace talks with the Gulf Clan.
Yes. Gustavo Petro's government has apparently invited the Gulf Clan, which is the country's largest strictly criminal gang in terms of its legal status, has invited it to peace talks, open peace talks. The Gulf Clan leadership has apparently accepted. This was announced on Tuesday. The Gulf Clan has about 9,000 fighters in its ranks, or is believed to. It's one of the largest armed groups in Colombia, and it's also one of the most active, by which I mean as other armed groups sort of enter into negotiations with the Colombian government and kind of stand down. The Gulf Clan has been challenging these groups and challenging them for territory and other things. So it's almost an impediment to negotiations with other armed groups as part of Petro's overall peace plan. There's a problem with these talks, because as I said, the Gulf Clan legally is classified as a criminal gang as opposed to a rebel group, an ideological or political group like the National Liberation Army, the ELN, like the ex-FARC factions that are in negotiations with Petro's government. And so the law that's governed sort of the peace talks and Petro's outreach to those other groups doesn't apply legally to the Gulf Clan because of this status. So it's unclear how Petro is going to get around that. Nevertheless, this is a pretty big deal. If the talks make any progress, it could be a pretty big deal for, again, his overarching plan to kind of ratchet down Colombia's armed conflicts, many armed conflicts.
Let's stay in the relative region and talk about Haiti. Could you give us an update on the CARICOM transition plan?
Yes, I think, you know, we talked about this on Tuesday in our interview, but the Caribbean community has been pushing this transition plan, seemingly without a lot of Haitian input, to move on from Ariel Henry, the prime minister who's resigning. They are trying to set up a presidential council. According to CARICOM earlier this week, the council is almost ready to go. It was supposed to be a 9-person council. It's down to 8 because one of the parties invited to submit a member to the council, a political party called Petit Dessalines, has rejected the whole idea of the council, largely because it's, you know, coming from outside Haiti, as so many things do, I guess. And so they're refusing to participate.
So one of the things, as we talk about this story, as the violence escalates, is, you know, Haitians must be in charge of this. What is the problem with the Haitian proposal that the U.S. doesn't like?
The problem was that Haitians were in charge of this, as you said.
So there are 6 political blocks, I guess, and 2 members, sort of at-large members, one drawn from Haitian civil society and one drawn from the Haitian religious community. And it's apparently ready to go. It will be charged with appointing a prime minister to replace Henri, appointing a cabinet, appointing a new electoral commission to work toward actual elections at some point. It's far from clear whether it will actually have any legitimacy. There's no indication that the insurgent groups that are, currently running amok in Port-au-Prince have, are going to accept the authority of this presidential council, and whether any Haitians will is up in the air. It's, again, mostly because it's a product of a non-Haitian political process, a product of the Caribbean community with U.S. input, creating this transition that, this political transition for Haitians on their behalf, in a sense, without actually checking with the Haitians and letting them have a say in it, which is a theme, again, we talked about on Tuesday, but is a theme in Haitian history, that Haitians must never be allowed to run Haiti. And that's this is just more of that.
Very grim stuff. And Derek, we saved our grimmest and most surprising news actually for last. So why don't you just introduce it, and everyone, I hope you're sitting down, but Derek, just go for it. Just lay it bare.
A new study this week found that there is no evidence that anyone who has claimed to have suffered from Havana syndrome has actually suffered any brain injury. This is significant because previous studies of the symptoms of the alleged phenomenon that may or may not have been caused by an evil ray gun that nobody's been able to find have suggested that, they can't really find an underlying cause for the rather commonplace symptoms that people cite: headache, dizziness, etc., those kinds of things. The previous studies have suggested that they can't find any commonality or underlying condition to explain these things, but there is a possibility that the people who are suffering from this alleged syndrome have suffered brain injury, concussion, or some other kind of thing, which is interesting. I mean, that would be, if it were true, an interesting feature. It's apparently either not true, or whatever brain injury that might have been caused to these people by the ray gun or whatever we're talking about has gone away, because this new study found no lingering evidence of any brain injury. So I guess if you want to spin this in a positive way, you could say, yes, these people all were suffering from a very real thing called Havana syndrome, but they got better. So that's good. On the other hand, what it seems more likely to mean is that there never was anything called Havana syndrome, and that it was something that we made up in a fit of hysteria, and that the media gladly picked up and ran with.
Well, Derek, on that note, thank you everyone for listening, and we'll see you again soon. Bye.
Bye.